accessibility in comparison to other key sites of alien-related interest, namely those in the far south, made Nanso a hugely popular destination despite the region's delicate diplomatic situation. A handful of appropriately gargantuan Western-style hotels had already opened following fast-track construction ordered to deal with an influx that was far too vast for the existing guest houses to accommodate, and many more were almost ready. Several hours before Thursday's sun rose over North America, its setting over Nanso signaled the end of the most frenzied day in the resort's history. Excitement over the Kerguelen Bolide was more fervorous here than anywhere, with many visitors not just hoping but expecting that something incredible would happen at any moment. Nothing incredible or even noteworthy had come to pass, but that wouldn't stop anyone emerging from their hotels the next morning with similar expectations and a fierce determination to obtain a good view. What thousands of sleeping tourists didn't know was that the lake's immediate vicinity would be under full lockdown before they had the chance. A member of one small tour group, returning to his hotel after an exhausting day-long excursion, spotted something as his bus turned a corner and its lights briefly illuminated what appeared to be a sizable group of people. "Look," he called. "What are all those guys doing?" When the bus drew to a halt, several of its passengers used their phones' flashlights to light up the area at the side of the road. They saw a large, stationary truck, with six men behind it busily placing a crowd control barrier directly across the entry point of one of the main tourist paths which led to the lake. "They can't be closing the lake without any warning," an American tourist said, quickly making his way down the aisle to get outside and ask what was going on. "My camera is at the time-lapse photography point. I need to get it." Inevitably, and despite their local interpreter's request, a handful of other tourists followed the first. The driver seemed far less concerned about this than the interpreter, and was himself gazing with great interest at the uniformed men. He opened the door and followed the tourists outside. Immediately, two of the uniformed men approached the group and firmly instructed them to stay back.
"Stay back,"
one of the men demanded in heavily accented English. To the Western tourists, he and his colleagues looked Chinese, but theirs was not the uniform of the state or local police force. It was the uniform of the GSC Security Corps.
"My camera is in there," the American tried to explain. "You know, at the place where you can leave them to get a time-lapse? That cost me $20, and the camera was $400. How am I supposed to get it back if you block all of the entrances?"
"Phone down," the same GSC employee barked at another tourist. "No photographs."
The phone-holding tourist, a young French woman, continued to move her hand in a slow sideways motion as she captured a video of what was going on.
"They are locking us out of the entire area around the lake," she narrated in English, the language of her tour. "As you can see, they are..."
"Phone down," the man repeated, firmly enough to frighten the woman and simultaneously beckon his entire group to his side.
One of his colleagues, noticeably older than the other five and apparently in command, stepped to the front.
"You must go," he said, pointing down the road in a calm and relaxed manner. "You must go now. No trouble."
The Frenchwoman held her phone steadily, defiantly, and zoomed in on the GSC badge on the commander's uniform.
"He said go," the first man snapped, losing patience and pushing his hand into the woman's phone.
She stumbled backwards, losing her balance, then fell to the ground. In the seconds before the back of her head hit the ground, her still-recording phone captured the scowling face of a GSC employee staring down at her. Immediately, the commander verbally reprimanded his foolish underling and pushed him away in anger. However uncooperative she was being, it didn't take an expert to realize that first-person video footage of a Chinese GSC officer pushing a female Western tourist to the ground was not going to go down well with anyone. Chairman Godfrey and Chinese Premier Ding Ziyang's relationship was frosty at the best of times, and the embarrassment and trouble that this incident was sure to bring both could only test it even further. The fallen woman, dazed but not obviously injured in any serious way, slowly rose to her feet with the help of her local interpreter.
The commander began speaking quickly and angrily to the interpreter as soon as he noticed the man's presence, clearly lambasting him for being stupid enough to let the tourists leave the bus. He pointed down the road again, far more forcefully than before, at which point the interpreter told his tourists that they really did have to get out of there and travel the last few hundred meters to their hotel as quickly as possible. "I still need my camera," the American tourist insisted. "I'm not going home without..." "Do you want to go home at all?" the interpreter asked, physically ushering the man back onto the bus despite his repeated protestations. The young French tourist, gingerly retaking her seat at the back of the bus, rubbed her head on the spot where it felt like a bruise was sure to develop, and then inspected the back of her phone for damage. Like her head, it was more or less fine, aside from a small mark near the top. She then turned it around and looked at the front. She navigated to her most recent video recording, tapped to select, and posted it online. By the time she reached her hotel, the footage would be everywhere.
C-minus 83. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. A flashing notification on Dan's wall-mounted trend ticker alerted him to a piece of footage which was going viral at a remarkable pace. The incident, a run-in between Western tourists and GSC staff near Lake Namso, didn't strike him as overly important. A storm in a teacup, he thought. Dan cared far more about the recent news that Billy Kendrick was now safely out of the GSC's makeshift holding cell, news he had heard directly from Billy in a short but friendly phone call in which Billy shared every detail he remembered of the remarkable bolide. His tone was almost euphoric as he spoke about the beautiful and life-affirming sight of the meteor as it sped to its death high above Kerguelen. There had also been a piece of news about Dan's friend Timo Fiori, who had supposedly moved a major announcement forward by a full week and would soon be addressing the world's press to reveal something that he promised would exceed their expectations. But what Dan had been most interested in throughout the night was the emergence of hard observational data regarding the Kerguelen bolide itself. The best estimates, so far reported only by journalists rather than authoritatively published by any GSC facilities, placed the meteor at 15 to 18 meters in diameter and stated its estimated kinetic energy to have been around 20 times greater than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Both of these numbers were slightly below those of the incident at Chelyabinsk, which captured the world's attention in February of 2013, but Kerguelen's was nevertheless a bona fide super bolide, ranking comfortably in the top five modern examples. Obvious media comparisons were made throughout the night to not only the Chelyabinsk super bolide, but also to the less understood but highly intriguing Tunguska event of a century earlier. Closer to home, the Great Daylight Fireball of 1972, an Earth-grazing asteroid which passed within 35 miles of the planet's surface before escaping the atmosphere 1,000 miles from its entry point, was cited as a similarly awe-inspiring event. But as interesting as the grainy images of that fireball were, the clear skies and unobstructed vistas around Kerguelen, allied with massive advances in mobile photography, ensured that the footage of the previous day's super bolide was the best ever seen, effortlessly blowing any billion-dollar special effects budget out of the water. Dan rolled his eyes a few times when the news media exhibited their penchant for fear-mongering, lacking concern partly because he had a first-hand understanding of how they operated, but mainly because he knew there was nothing to be scared of. He understood that fear itself could become a problem at some point if people became hysterical amid the media's best efforts to revive the narrative of potential hostility, but this concern was mild. After all, he had to believe that the messengers were too smart to ever let it get to that stage. Several requests for interviews arrived in Dan's dormant social media accounts, but his desire to engage with anyone could not have been lower. Via the social media meta-analysis software on his computer, a purchase inspired by the powerful app he'd first seen on Emma's phone, Dan could track how often he was discussed across all platforms. He saw a few very noticeable spikes from the previous 12 hours,
with the highest coming after a name check by Joe Crabb during the professional agitator's appearance on Blitz News. It pleased Dan that his discussion-based popularity now spiked when other people mentioned him, rather than the other way around, as used to be the case. His efforts to maintain a low profile throughout the past year had evidently paid off, and he didn't normally mind the occasional mention from someone like Crabb, because, as the long-term trend graphs showed, the attention always faded quickly enough. This time, however, he had a feeling it would be different. This time the attention wouldn't stay faded for long, he thought, because something told him that the Kerguelen bolide was just the first stage of a much broader happening. Dan couldn't pretend he wasn't disappointed that nothing else had happened overnight, whether it was another bolide or whatever else, but he still refused to even consider the possibility of coincidence. Kerguelen was too remote for that, as pretty much everyone else seemed to agree. But he had an even stronger reason to be confident. To Dan, the near paralyzing twinge in his neck during the incident could only mean one thing. The messengers had intervened. The messengers, without doubt, were close. C-82. 10 Downing Street, London, England. "Surely now?" John Cole said, pointing to his television, and no longer even trying to hide his exasperation at Jack Neal's repeated calls for patience. "Chinese GSC gods intimidating Western tourists? It writes itself." To Cole's mind, the time to hit Godfrey had been immediately after the Kerguelen bolide. It was written in the stars, he told Jack, citing the near-blinding irony of the fact that Dan McCarthy's decision to leak the infamous IDA documents in the first place had coincided with a march against Godfrey's leadership, just as the bolide had coincided with one against Cole's. The big difference was that Godfrey had been forced to seize upon McCarthy's leak out of sheer desperation in the hours before a huge protest was set to close down central London for the day, whereas Cole had now been presented with an opportunity to entrench a relatively strong position just one day after a well-timed downpour had saved his own blushes by postponing his detractors' big day out. Cole, never one to miss an opportunity to look strong, had stood defiantly in the storm and promised the handful of hardy camera crews outside Number 10 that no act of God, man, or nature would ever hold him back from doing his utmost to keep Britain safe. With no umbrella or jacket, Cole was soaked to the bone in a T-shirt emblazoned with the faces of several recent victims of terrorist attacks. A T-shirt he wore despite most of those victims' families pleading with him not to. And since then, to Cole's mind, his position had only gotten stronger. "If the time's not now, when the hell is it?" he asked. Jack Neal stood his ground. "Soon." Jack was playing a difficult game in attempting to temper the worst of Cole's impatience without tipping him over the edge, and on some occasions this required exaggerated words. One such instance had come only a day earlier when Jack boasted that he had more than enough ammunition to hurt Dan McCarthy via Emma Ford should Dan involve himself on the wrong side of certain issues. Despite their differences, Jack had no desire to hurt Emma, his former protege, and he considered his raising of the possibility to be a regrettably necessary way of stopping Cole from diving headfirst into anything foolish, as he might, if he ever came to think that Jack was unwilling or unable to act decisively. "I swear," Cole moaned, "if Slater gets in first because you make me wait to—"
"She won't say anything firm on this, boss," Jack insisted. "She probably won't say anything at all. You know how she's been lately."
It was certainly true that both President Slater and Chairman Godfrey had been very reserved in their public manner over the last few months, almost as though they were deliberately staying out of all difficult controversies in the expectation that with enough rope, Cole would eventually hang himself. Another posited reason for their lack of personal engagement, referenced by the media on both sides of the Atlantic, was that everyone by now knew that it was impossible to come out of any spat with John Cole looking good. Indeed, when Cole had on occasion directed testing jabs in the direction of his former mentor, Godfrey had brushed them off, and overtly asserted that he knew better than to wrestle with a chimney sweep and expect to come out clean. President Slater, meanwhile, mentioned Cole as rarely as possible. Her approval ratings were too high to risk getting drawn into any petty spats, and most balanced observers now tended to consider her a competent president who had been tremendously unlucky to be in office during the tumultuous months of Richard Walker's self-inflicted fall from grace.
"So how soon is soon?" Cole asked, champing at the bit to make Godfrey's life difficult by driving a well-placed wedge between him and the Chinese government over the potentially combustible situation at Nanzhou.
The combination of a flair for controversy like Cole's and a PR intellect like Jack's was tailor-made for the prevailing political climate, one in which any idea that couldn't be condensed into a quotable 5-second soundbite was widely seen as one not worth having, and Cole saw every moment when they weren't making the most of their synergistic gifts as a moment wasted. Jack leaned back in his chair.
"Boss, anything we say in the next 2 hours will have a shelf life of 2 hours."
"What are you talking about?"
"This came in from one of my Italian sources," Jack said, flicking through some photos on his phone and settling on the right one. "A courier transported it to the Cavalieri Observatory a few days ago."
"Is that Fiore's place?"
Cole asked as he reached for the phone.
"The very same. I don't know what he's going to talk about when he addresses the media in 2 hours, but I think it's safe to say that if it's anything to do with this photo..."
"Godfrey's going to have a shit fit," Cole beamed, his eyes wide in delighted surprise. "He'll be all over the place, distracted, vulnerable, ripe for the picking."
Jack nodded slowly and put his phone back in his pocket.
"One of these days you're going to realize that I really do know what I'm doing, boss," he said through a thin smile.
Cole said nothing, but he had never been more glad to have Jack Neal at his side. C-81. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. At 8 a.m., Clark pressed the intercom button on the basement door to tell Dan that Emma was there to see him. Dan opened the door to find Clark in his police uniform and Emma dressed even more smartly than ever.
"I don't have long," Emma said, walking down the stairs. "I just wanted to see how you're doing and tell you that I'll be in the city all day. I've got to deal with some stupid campaign emergency. Not even my client. It's a favor to someone I owe more than a few."
"It's going to be a long day at the precinct, too," Clark said. "No one will shut up about Kerguelen from the minute I get there."
When Clark had started his new job, the presence of someone moderately famous had been a novelty for his colleagues. To his relief, that novelty had faded quickly enough. But now, just like general interest in everything else related to the messengers, Clark himself was going to be a focus of attention all over again in the aftermath of the Kerguelen bolide.
"So how are you doing?" Emma asked Dan.
She didn't sit down, clearly serious about not having much time.
"Have you been awake all night?"
Dan shook his head.
"I got like 3, maybe 3.5 hours of sleep," he said, speaking without irony, as though this was comfortably enough.
Emma then glanced up to the scrolling trend ticker, seeing a new and rapidly trending post from Billy Kendrick, which plainly stated his firm belief that the bolide was a deliberate sign from the messengers, and which ended with the upbeat sign-off, "It's a good time to be alive." She pointed up to the scrolling text.
"See? I'm willing to accept it was them. Okay, you felt it, I believe you. But look at that. Billy thinks it was a sign. Pretty much everyone does. If this was a message for you, like you think it is, why would it be so public? They could call you somewhere like before, or even if, for some totally unknown reason, they were determined to use a meteor to catch your attention, why wouldn't it be somewhere like Lolo? Somewhere that we know is relevant, but somewhere no one else cares about."
Dan pursed his lips and nodded slightly in recognition of what were undeniably fair and measured questions.
"She's right, man," Clark chimed in. He, too, was nodding, taking another long look at Dan's in-depth Heilig research, at his many densely annotated maps, and at his large posters of the 3 already discovered plaques.
"And the aliens are on our side.
So even if they did want to tell us something important and to do it specifically through you, why would it be so cryptic?
Henry's voice played over the intercom before Dan had a chance to answer.
Emma, he called.
Dan turned to face her.
Are you getting a cab into the city?
She shook her head.
Dan then held the intercom button to speak to Henry.
What is it?
He asked.
Her phone is ringing, Henry replied.
As Dan and Clark both knew, an extremely small number of people were whitelisted to be allowed straight through on Emma's phone outside of business hours.
Tara,
Emma suddenly said, clicking her fingers as it hit her.
She's due back in town tomorrow.
Oh, goody,
Clark said under his breath. Emma laughed, hearing Clark's words and wordlessly sharing his lack of enthusiasm.
What's wrong with Tara?
Dan asked. He had only met Emma's younger sister a few times, but she'd always seemed nice enough.
Hurry up and pick up anyway, she might need something.
She always does, Emma said. That's the point.
Henry was holding out Emma's phone when she opened the door.
It stopped, he said. I didn't want to answer it.
Emma took it from his hand.
Thanks. Did it say it was Tara?
He shrugged. I didn't unclip the case.
After looking at the screen for several seconds, Emma handed her phone back to Henry and asked him to put it back on the coffee table.
It's nothing important. Thanks again, though.
Sure thing.
When Emma reclosed the basement door and turned around, Dan spoke first.
You could at least call her back and say you can't talk right now. She'll be sitting somewhere wondering why you didn't take her call.
Get your shoes,
Emma said, pointing to the pair on Dan's floor.
Clark, yours too, wherever they are. We're going to my place. My phone won't work down here, and we can't call him upstairs when your dad's there.
Call who?
Clark asked, this time beating Dan to the punch.
Who's the him?
Starts with T,
Emma said, turning back to the door.
Rhymes with Nemo.
C-80. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado.
There's just no way this house is the same size as ours, Clark said, repeating a frequent thought as he sank into the plush, circular couch in the corner of Emma's spacious living room.
Emma and Dan, more focused on the issue at hand, wasted no time in getting down to it.
Do you know anything about the thing Timo is doing today?
Emma asked. Dan shrugged. I know he's doing it, and I know that it was originally supposed to be next week. The fact that he's bringing it forward must mean it has something to do with Kerguelen, right?
It doesn't have to mean that, Emma said. Obviously, today is a good day to publicize anything remotely linked to Kerguelen or aliens or anything like that, but it's also a perfect day to bury bad news. You know Timo as well as I do, and that guy has his fingers in a lot of pies. He could be closing a company or announcing a sell-off or something like that.
Why would he invite the press for that? And why would it be at the observatory?
To try and spin whatever he's doing is a good thing, probably. That might be why he wants to talk to me, for some last-minute advice. Maybe he's closing the observatory, maybe he's selling it. We're about to find out.
Emma then held a finger to her lips as the phone rang.
Ah, Emma,
Timo said, greeting her as warmly as he had when he welcomed the trio into his second home at Lake Maggiore a year earlier.
I'm so glad you called back. How is everything? Dan, Clark, Birchwood, all well, I hope?
Everything's pretty busy, she replied. I actually have to leave in a couple of minutes. Did you need something urgent?
In that case, I will be brief. I'm coming to New York on Sunday, Emma, for a Focus 2020 taping. I want you to be there.
Are you sure about that?
She asked.
You weren't listed in the preliminary lineup I saw last night.
They'll find a space when they see my surprise in a few hours. So can I count on you?
Emma turned to Dan, who held up his right thumb.
So long as you're definitely on the panel and you're willing to meet my fee, she said. Sure thing.
How much is your fee?
Timo, if you have to ask, you can't afford it.
He laughed heartily down the line.
I'll try to scrape some funds together from somewhere.
Can I speak?
Dan mouthed silently. Emma gave him the phone.
Hey, Timo, Dan said. Dan, what a pleasant surprise. And do I have a surprise for you, my friend? I only wish you were here to see it for yourself.
What is it? Dan asked, not even trying to hide his childlike excitement. Did you find something out about the bolide?
Clark jumped up from the comfortable couch and moved towards his younger brother, ready to grab the phone if he sensed Dan's words heading in a prohibited direction. Dan tried to shoo him away with his hand, nodding and mouthing, "I know," to make it clear that he wasn't going to say anything he'd regret.
"No, no, no. It's nothing like that," Timo said. "I just wanted to make the most of some fortuitous timing."
"So what are you doing at your media thing? What's the surprise?"
"Oh, nothing much," Timo said with a boyish tone of his own. Dan could almost hear him smiling all the way from Italy.
"Just unilaterally ending William Godfrey's illegitimate monopoly on deep space research and exploration."
Dan's eyes lit up like the bolide itself.
"And that's not all, Dan. I have been working on something else. Something for our messenger friends." Having heard these words through the phone, Clark now moved even closer to Dan, ready to grab it at any second. It wasn't that he thought Dan would say anything on purpose, but the danger of a slip-up was always there.
"I really do need to get going," Emma interjected.
"At least give me a clue," Dan said to Timo, ignoring the hint. "The announcement isn't for 2 whole hours.
Timo chuckled warmly at Dan's enthusiasm.
"One clue," he agreed, "and then I hang up."
"Deal," Dan said, leaning away from Emma as she spun her finger in the air in a hurry-up motion.
"I am looking at it right now," Timo said, sounding almost like a proud parent. "And I am calling her Reciprocity." Part 2. Reciprocity. Truth is the only safe ground to stand upon. Elizabeth Cady Stanton. C-79. Cavalieri Observatory, Trento, Italy.
"I'm glad that you could all make it," Timo Fiori said, addressing the few dozen reporters who had rushed to his flagship observatory at very short notice. He sat alone at a long desk in the observatory's lavishly decorated media room, dressed in a pastel blue suit and a white shirt.
"And I can assure you that you will be glad you did."
To his left, a large object lay covered by many national flags. The reporters, from their vantage point, could only see the handful of flags on one side of the object, those of the United States, the United Kingdom, China, Russia, Argentina, Norway, France, and Italy. Timo's suit and tie combination bore more than a passing resemblance to the Argentine flag, which in turn evoked strong memories of the moment when a mysterious sphere, discovered off the coast of Miramar and raised from the ocean in a shark cage, had been wheeled into public view with that very flag draped over it until the grand reveal. The symbolism was so overt that no one had to ask whether it was intentional, but Timo had firmly instructed the reporters to focus on his words until the time came for the object to be unveiled.
"I will waste no more of your time on introductions, ladies and gentlemen, and I will be as brief as I can. I have gathered you here today to document my announcement of nothing less than a privately funded but publicly minded space program. Our program is ambitious and intergenerational in scope. Through a not-for-profit umbrella organization to be known as Fiori Frontieri, distinct divisions will research, fund, and develop tangible technologies to both expand humanity's reach in the universe and safeguard our planet."
Excited murmurs began to spread among the reporters.
"The Global Space Commission, regardless of the good intentions surrounding its formation, has proven unfit for purpose. The list of tangible achievements that the GSC has made in the last year is not just indefensibly short, it is practically non-existent. The GSC has centralized a lot of funding and united a lot of smart people under one banner, but it is without doubt the most bloated institution I have ever seen. Take RS-1, the research station Chairman Godfrey announced in the wake of the third Plax discovery. Here we are, a year later,
yet here we are, no further ahead. And the same goes for DS-2. For operational reasons, I am limited in what I can divulge right now in terms of Fiori Frontieri's specific initial focuses, but I can, in no particular order, touch on three of our planned projects. One such project will see tremendous resources devoted to the development and construction of an intergenerational ark capable of transporting a viable human population to a distant planet. The second project I can currently reveal, which will be physically realized in years rather than decades, is our Tinia telescope. Named after the Etruscan god of the sky, Tinia will become the cornerstone of an extensive orbital observation platform. Tinia has been designed, and its construction will begin imminently. However, both the name and the final design of the larger orbital observation platform are open to suggestions and will be the subjects of a global contest with a generous prize for the chosen winner in each category. But while only two winners will emerge from that contest, Timo continued, rising to his feet and walking towards the large flag-covered object. The third project I can announce today is participatory in nature and is, to my mind, the most immediately exciting of the three. Aside from the utility of this third project, it will also serve as something for humanity to unite around at a time when good news is at a premium. There will be cynics, and there will be naysayers, as always, but I haven't cared about them so far, and I'm not about to start doing so now. Ladies and gentlemen of the press, citizens of the world, without further ado, I give you reciprocity. Timo whisked away the mosaic banner of national flags to reveal a full-scale model of a capsule-like space probe. As reporters oohed and aahed while positioning themselves to capture the best images, Timo crouched to the floor and lifted two large plaques from underneath the reciprocity probe. "Like Voyager before it," he said, walking back to his desk with the plaques in his hands. "Reciprocity will traverse the solar system and continue forth carrying messages from humanity. The difference this time, of course, is that we know we are not alone. This time we will send messages based on those we have already received. The content of our messages, engraved on plaques compositionally similar to those we have received, will not build upon humanity's previous outgoing messages. Instead, we will build upon the incoming messages which have come to light in recent times." Timo carefully stood the two large plaques on his desk, revealing their example engravings of various detailed shapes, symbols, and text. The mundanity of the placeholder content momentarily disappointed the attendant reporters, but their level of intrigue over the broader project was more than sufficient to ensure that these feelings didn't last for long. "Symbols and scales for representing distance and time have already been established by the messengers, and we will compose our reply with that in mind," Timo continued. "Another core difference from previous active SETI efforts is that rather than sending masses of information about ourselves and our planet, we will be focusing squarely on facilitating future radio contact with the messengers. If I want someone to contact me, I don't draw them a picture of every room in my house and tell them all about my hobbies and my family. No, I give them my phone number. And I should add something. This is a long-term project. We cannot be certain when reciprocity will reach its recipients. Indeed, we cannot be certain who those recipients will be. Little over a year ago, we did not know of the existence of any intelligent extraterrestrial races. We now know of at least one. At least one. For this reason, we will be consulting with experts in several disciplines to make our messages as universally clear as possible, including mathematicians and linguists. On the subject of language, the written messages we include will be in one language only. I am a man who cares about languages and speaks five of them, but whenever I want to communicate with someone who only speaks a sixth, which of mine do you think I try first? English, of course. Cultural dominance by no means indicates cultural superiority, but it is my view that previous active SETI efforts using small snippets of various languages have been ill-advised and motivated more by a desire to be seen as inclusive than by a desire to communicate effectively. In other areas, we are going to invite suggestions via our website as to what non-essential information should be represented in the limited space available for that purpose. Civilizational and technological progress,
our move from mud huts and igloos to cities full of skyscrapers in the course of a few thousand years, is the kind of thing I am looking for. Nothing negative will be included. No mushroom clouds, no famines, no flattened rainforests. For those who would rather introduce humanity to an extraterrestrial race by putting our worst foot forward, I politely suggest that you fund and develop your own probe. Derision dripped from Timo's words during this part of his announcement, as though he had already had these kinds of discussions behind the scenes. The inclusion process will not be democratic for the simple reason that I do not want it to turn into a childish popularity contest, he went on. There will be ways to highlight and support other people's ideas, but I will make the final decisions based on merit rather than popularity. For those at home asking the obvious question, the answer is no. We do not yet have a set target destination. But as with our highly ambitious intergenerational arc, we see little sense in postponing preparations until the precise destination is known. This is more crucial for the arc, since the propulsion technologies and physical development of such a craft are admittedly beyond the realms of current science, but it is also true of reciprocity. We will act as if we know where we are heading. That way, when we do know, we will be ready. Needless to say, Tinia and her sister telescopes will tirelessly search for signs of the planet many already speak of as New Kerguelen. And our search for that planet will be exponentially deeper and better funded than any comparable endeavor of the past. And, speaking of the past, in the recent past, the chief obstacles for our space-related ambitions have been political rather than technical. Today, I will no longer allow political challenges to prevent scientific progress. My message to our many supporters around the world is a simple one. The petty squabbles of self-interested and power-addicted politicians will no longer be allowed to stand in humanity's way. Details relating to the location of our production bases and launch facilities will be forthcoming, but my final announcement of the day is that Fiori Frontieri will be headquartered at the old IDA building in Colorado Springs. Securing the building wasn't cheap, but we considered the investment worthwhile given the historic symbolism of the location. In a building where one man worked for so long to suppress evidence of the messenger's existence, we will work twice as hard to usher in a harmonious future of active engagement and cooperation with those very same messengers. I will now end with the immortal words of my good friend, Dan McCarthy. Timo said. He rose to his feet. From truth comes hope. So here's to the truth. C-78. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. In the administrative headquarters of the Global Space Commission, the building where he now spent almost all of his time, GSC Chairman William Godfrey sat at the head of a long glass table in the company of his bloated inner circle of scientific and media advisors. None of them had previously known a mood like it, with compounding difficulties continuing to pile up, and Godfrey deciding that maintaining what he deemed a dignified public silence was the best way forward for now. The Kerguelen bolide alone presented a significant challenge, raising as it did many troubling questions about the GSC's current abilities to detect and defend against incoming planetary threats. Since then, a regrettable flare-up between international tourists and the GSC Security Corps officers stationed at Lake Nantso had piled on even more pressure. This posed a very different, but no less difficult challenge than did the bolide, particularly with Ding Ziyang having already expressed his strong displeasure that the GSC employees in question were being widely reported as Chinese guards, following Godfrey's clumsy description of them as such before he had been fully briefed on the incident. But Timo Fiori's recent statement of his intent to launch several space-based projects took the biscuit, posing nothing less than an existential threat to the GSC. As several members of Godfrey's inner circle were insistently telling him, they simply couldn't be seen to let Timo get away with it. No one was legally entitled to launch anything into space without explicit approval and an announcement of plans to disregard that cornerstone of the GSC's charter was an overt challenge to the commission itself. "I'll deal with Timo personally in New York on Sunday," Godfrey said.
referring to his own as-yet-unannounced appearance on Focus 2020 in 3 days' time.
Namso will have blown over by then, and he's not going to do or say anything else beforehand.
Ever since Jack Neal had scampered off to John Cole's side like the little rat he was, Godfrey had given up listening to too much of what any single media advisor told him. Trust was an issue, of course, but more generally, Godfrey had come to detest his own increasing dependence on Jack prior to cutting him out. In one particular moment of clarity, Godfrey realized that he had been succeeding in politics for long enough without a PR-focused nobody at his side, and that such nobodies were better suited to working with weak role-fillers like Cole and President Slater, or accidental celebrities like Dan McCarthy. For all of the old man's flaws, Godfrey had never seen Richard Walker, weak in no one's eyes, walking around with a manicured yes-man on his arm. He likewise had no memories of any of the bygone British politicians he admired so much ever changing their minds based on news cycles or media analysis. They were strong enough to stand on their own 2 feet. They didn't need Jack Neal's or Emma Ford's, and neither did he.
"You have to be strong on this," said one of the faces in his crowd. The young woman was English, like most of the media advisors.
"It takes strength to take your time," Godfrey replied.
"Silence is weakness," she insisted. Godfrey pointed to the door.
"Get out!
You can't be serious."
"Out!"
he bellowed, slamming his fist against the desk firmly enough to elicit physical recoils from most of the people sitting around it.
"And that goes for anyone else who wants to question me."
None of the young media advisor's colleagues joined her as she sulked out of the room with her tail between her legs. Nor did any of them ask why they were there if Godfrey didn't want their input, even if they couldn't help but wonder. The science advisors, meanwhile, sat just as uncomfortably.
"Now, if we can forget about the side issues and get back to the bolide," he said, almost petulantly and with one eye on the tablet computer in his hand. "In fact, all of the media people, out. This isn't for you."
They looked around at each other, as though unsure whether he was serious. Godfrey answered this question by walking to the door and holding it open.
"Hurry up. You're not all fired, only her. The rest of you, I just need you to get out. Go and work on something to take the shine off our friend Timo's little reciprocity shenanigans. One of you mentioned the cultural insensitivity of what he said about civilizational progress, I believe. Latch on to that. Get an outrage campaign up and running with some over-the-top clickbait. If all goes well, we might even snare Cole by working him into siding with Timo. And there we have it, all of our enemies lined up in a row."
30 seconds later, Godfrey closed the door and returned to his seat. The room was now sparsely populated by 6 of the GSC's science advisors, who acted as go-betweens to ensure that Godfrey was always up to speed on important developments at any of the Commission's worldwide facilities.
"Okay, so the latest data was not what I expected, and it raised some new questions," Godfrey said. "Do we have any new answers?"
"Yes, sir," said a middle-aged Argentine. "An hour ago, I reported that analysis of the meteor's initial entry showed it to be highly irregular, in the collective words of our senior analysis team. They wrote this in an official memorandum which also stated that they were awaiting comparative data from elsewhere, which would either strengthen or challenge their assumptions regarding these apparent irregularities."
"Your expression says it strengthened them," Godfrey observed.
The man nodded, an extremely uneasy look on his face.
"Sir, in the last few minutes, their description of the event at Kerguelen has changed from highly irregular to observably unnatural."
C-77. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. After a long day apart due to Emma and Clark's respective work obligations, Emma brought the trio back together by inviting both of the McCarthy brothers over as soon as she was home. It made sense for them to talk at her house, as she explained. She wasn't very comfortable in the enclosed basement, for starters, and they couldn't risk speaking elsewhere in the McCarthy's house in case Henry overheard anything. Henry himself had spent the day like he spent most others, doing bits and pieces of administrative work for the fire department. He had taken to the desk job easily enough, and certainly far better than Clark had taken to his. Back when a respiratory problem ruled him out of active military duty and ultimately led to his move into high-risk but highly paid private security work, with everyone's understanding and best wishes. Since being gravely injured in the act of saving a child from a collision with an oncoming car, Henry had tried to remain philosophical by thinking himself blessed to be doing any kind of work at all after the near-fatal crash left him in a coma for 18 days.
"I'd rather be sitting on my ass in this wheelchair than lying on my back in a casket," he sometimes said. "And those are the only choices I've got."
At Emma's, the obvious and immediate topic of conversation was Timo Fiori's remarkable and brazen announcement that he intended to launch his own space program based at the old IDA building in Colorado Springs. His proposed reciprocity probe had garnered most of the resulting headlines, partly because the presence of a full-scale model made it feel more real than his future plans for an orbital observation platform and even an intergenerational ark. Dan, despite knowing that much of what everyone else believed to be true was in fact part of a hoax devised by Richard Walker and Hans Kloster, couldn't help but feel excited about the reciprocity probe. He couldn't help but imagine the inhabitants of an alien planet discovering the probe and wondrously examining its contents, largely because he couldn't help but agree with Timo's comment that there might well be multiple intelligent races scattered through the vastness of space. And just because the messenger's race was already aware of humanity, Dan figured, that didn't mean they all were. As well as generating excitement and interest, reciprocity also reignited the dormant debate over the wisdom, or otherwise, of actively trying to communicate with anyone. As the news media's reaction to the Kerguelen bolide underlined, some still feared aliens even in a post-disclosure and post-Salzburg world. Timo's optimistically spoken point about the possibility of there being multiple alien races was turned on its head, with critics arguing that sending instructions on how to reach Earth was foolish and would likely prove fatal if those directions ever fell into the hands of a hostile race. Ever since the existence of one alien race came to light, many had considered it likely that others would follow. And to this day, many still feared that those others could well turn out to be conquest-driven beasts rather than information-sharing allies. The argument was as familiar as it was simple. Just because we know that some aliens are friendly, that doesn't mean they all are. Though Dan had no one to argue with, he quietly understood that the distances involved, particularly relative to the small probe's likely speed of travel, meant that it would take thousands of years for reciprocity to reach another star system. Like the Voyager Golden Records, the real value in the discussions over the messages to be included on reciprocity's plaques was the value of such discussions as a frame for useful thought experiments and as a means of bringing people together. For much of the long day, Dan had been so caught up in the excited reaction to the reciprocity announcement that he temporarily postponed his own theorizing over the meaning of the Kerguelen bolide. He was surprised that Godfrey still hadn't said anything outside of one short overnight radio interview, either about the bolide or about Timo. But it was not a disappointed kind of surprise. "There's something I've been thinking about," he said to Emma after a general discussion of the day's events. "You're going to be with Timo in a few days, so what if we tell him some of the truth without telling him anything about the lie? He talked about looking for new Kerguelen, and there are two things we know that could really narrow the search parameters. The first thing is that the messengers could walk and breathe without suits in an environment where we could do the same, which tells us certain things about the kind of environment they evolved in. And the second thing, the main thing, is that they told me we have a name for their home star, but not for their home planet. If we told Timo that I met the messengers..." Clark responded first, with some general obscenities coloring his disbelief at Dan's suggestion. Emma raised a finger to ask him to be quiet. "Dan," she said, "I thought we were on the same page about this." "We are. I didn't say we should say anything about the hoax. Just that we could maybe tell Timo that we met aliens and that they told us a few things. And I said Timo, okay? Not everyone. Not Cole or Godfrey or anyone else. Not even Billy or my dad. Timo. He's the only guy who could take the info we have and act on it in a positive way.
What even makes you think they'd let you tell him?
Emma asked.
They told us they'd interfere if Walker tried to talk.
Exactly. They didn't say they'd interfere if I did.
Because we didn't ask, Dan. We weren't stupid enough to be thinking about that. Just listen to me for 1 minute, okay? Because as soon as any part of this is out, it's all out. Don't kid yourself on that. And the second you told someone, you would wish you hadn't. This thing is a weight we have to bear. We didn't ask for it, but we've sure as hell got it. And if you told someone, you would immediately realize that the weight wasn't lifted. It was just dumped onto them, too. Do you think this would be more difficult for the two of us if Clark didn't know? Do you think this would be easier for the three of us if your dad knew? No. It would just be equally as difficult for more people, and you would never sleep again because you'd be worried that they would spill it. We can trust ourselves and we can trust each other, and that's it. That's all. Okay?
Okay, Dan said quite brightly. Emma raised her eyebrows.
Dan, I said okay, no big deal. Well, it kind of is, which is why I need you to promise. I need you to promise me that you're going to stop thinking about this. Can you do that?
I promise. Emma turned to Clark.
Are you happy with that?
Do I look happy with that? He groaned. In turn, he looked at Dan. I swear to God, man, if I hear you talking about any shit like that again, you'll wish I hadn't. Jesus, Dan sighed. Last night you say nothing is off the table, no judgment, say whatever you think. Then today, Timo makes a big announcement, and I have an idea directly related to that, so I say it. I say it to the two of you, in here, in private. And now suddenly it's like judgment, judgment, judgment. I didn't say I'm gonna tell him, did I? I said, what if we did? But Emma said no, so that's it. You don't need to be such an asshole.
You think this is me being an asshole? Clark asked. Then you really don't want to see what happens if I hear you suggesting anything like that again.
Emma butted in.
Clark, that's enough.
No, it's not. If someone has an idea as stupid as that, you call it out. If you don't, you're just encouraging him to have more stupid ideas.
If he has ideas, I want to hear them, Emma said. Whether you think they're stupid or not, if he's going to have them, I want to know what they are. You want to just leave everything stewing in his head? You want him to tell someone else because we don't listen and the thoughts drive him crazy?
I am standing right here, Dan said. Emma put her hand around his back and rested it on his shoulder.
I know, sorry, but Clark, cut him some slack. However hard this is for us, we're not the ones who felt physical pain when the meteor came in, and we're not the ones who got called to the cornfield last time, okay? Stuff like that changes your perspective. So when Dan has an idea, he can tell us, without judgment.
Clark paused, then closed his eyes for a second and nodded slowly. I'm sorry too, man, but at the same time, try and see it from my side. If you were me and I was suggesting something like that, I'd probably lock you in the basement with no computer and no phone line, Dan said, laughing as he spoke. Emma lowered her hand from Dan's shoulder after suddenly noticing that it was still there.
Don't give him any ideas, Dan.
Anyway, I've got an early shift tomorrow, Clark said, clapping his hands together. Dan, you coming?
Dan nodded, then turned to Emma.
What are you doing tomorrow? Do you need to go into the city again for work? No, that was a one-time thing. Campaign emergency averted. Actually, I might have to go into the city to pick up a little something for your birthday next week, but that's it. Apart from that, I'll just be working from home, and I don't have much booked in. Why? What about you?
Dan shrugged. I'll see what comes up.
Cool. Well, I'll probably catch you sometime tomorrow, right?
Definitely, Dan said. See you later. As Dan walked to the door, Emma pulled Clark back, very subtly.
Be nice to him,
she mouthed. She was smiling, but Clark wasn't. The softer you get, the more I have to overcompensate, he whispered. Don't make this more difficult than it already is. He was gone before she could reply.
C-76. White House, Washington, D.C. Many in and around President Slater's administration had been keeping extremely close tabs on Timo Fiori's space-related investments and research projects for a long time. His decision to bring his various astronomical interests and facilities together under the new banner of Fiori Frontieri was more than a mere rebranding, however, and allied with the strength of Timo's comments, it showed that he really did mean business. Like Timo, several high-profile former NASA officials and employees had recently been growing acutely frustrated with the direction in which Godfrey had been taking the GSC. The glacial pace of any real progress beyond one admittedly impressive project was a constant source of annoyance, and some contended that the laudably short period of time taken to design and construct the Unity 1 rocket, which would ultimately launch Research Station 1, was less of a feather in the GSC's cap than it was an indication of the kind of progress that could have been simultaneously made on many distinct projects if the commission was more efficiently run. Respected voices within the security community had, for many months, stressed to President Slater the importance of ensuring that Timo never developed a direct cooperative relationship with either the Russians or the Chinese. There was no solid reason to think he ever would. Timo had never made any secret of his conviction that Western economic and democratic ideals were the foundational basis of human prosperity, and bribery couldn't tempt him any more than a snorkel could tempt a basking shark, but it remained unknown whether and how he could ever be tempted to work with any national governments at all should the GSC ultimately disintegrate, as so many predicted. In a post-GSC world in which international competition returned, it struck most political observers that Timo Fiori could well be the kingmaker whose cooperation with one reinstituted national space agency would decisively set it apart from the others. Timo's decision to headquarter Fiori Frontieri in the United States gave Slater reason to be hopeful as to which path he would ultimately take in such a post-GSC scenario. Nothing could be taken for granted, however, so she reaffirmed to her staff the importance of refraining from making any comments critical of Timo, while also avoiding any public criticisms of the GSC. Slater had walked tighter ropes at greater political altitudes, but striking an expedient balance between long and short-term considerations of these issues was anything but straightforward. Glancing at transient headlines on her computer screen, President Slater considered the point that the calls for comment on these issues were at least far less vociferous than the calls for comment about the IDA leak had been a year earlier. This time, there was no media circus in Birchwood or anywhere else, and even more importantly, this time there was no lightning rod in the mold of a Dan McCarthy for the public to march behind in their call for truth. And no Emma Ford to play the press like a fiddle and make my life a thousand times more difficult than it has to be, Slater reflected with an ironic grin. But as she thought back to the previous year and recalled just how friendly Timo had gotten with the troublemakers in Birchwood, Slater's grin faded. The fact that Billy Kendrick, another of their allies, was already wrapped up in the Kerguelen incident only increased the potential for an unwelcome change in the direction of current media narratives, and Slater didn't like some of the possibilities that arose in her mind. Ford and McCarthy are nowhere to be seen for now, she thought. But how long is for now? C-75. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. In the small hours of the night, Dan went upstairs to get a drink from the refrigerator. He didn't bother switching on the kitchen light, which was why he noticed a light outside the back door. Intrigued, he opened the door and stepped out. Several thoughts went through his mind, with the worst being that he would find one or more intruders sneaking around. He didn't think of this until the door was already open, but fortunately the fear was quickly proven to be unfounded. The light was coming from Emma's place, from a large, motion-activated floodlight above her back door. "Dan?" she said, responding quietly to the sound of the door, no louder than necessary in the silence of the night. He walked over to the high white fence. Their houses were around 10 meters apart, with two driveways and a flower bed in between, but at the back of their homes, only this fence separated the properties. The light from next door was enough to illuminate the recently reinvigorated vegetable plot on Dan's side of the fence, as well as the new stone pathway in the middle of the relayed lawn, leading to a shiny new tool shed built on the site of the rickety and leaky old one, which had stood for decades.
"What are you doing out at this time?"
he asked through the fence. It struck him as the obvious question.
"Couldn't sleep," Emma said. "I thought I might as well look at the stars instead of my bedroom ceiling. What about you?"
"Are you asking if I'd rather be looking at your bedroom ceiling?" Dan deadpanned. Emma laughed heartily.
"Oh, Dan, when did you learn to tell jokes like that?"
"It's really weird talking through a fence," he said, focusing on the suddenly dominant